Good morning, America. Welcome to Dialogue. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I host the Inside Scoop radio show on the Head On Radio Network, and I'm always honored to be here on Wednesdays, the occasional Wednesday on Pacifica Radio, to bring you the Inside Scoop on what's going on in the world, but more importantly, to dialogue with you, to discuss what can be done, what should be done about the events going on in the world. Today, I want to talk about Darfur. Now, most all of you have heard of Darfur by now. You'd have to be living in a cave not to. Some of you may not be able to put Darfur on a map, but most all of you know that something horrific is going on there. What's going on there, of course, is genocide. And I don't mean the way the word is sometimes used in some facile sense. I mean real genocide. Genocide. Taking men, women, and children out of a village that has existed for centuries, indigenous peoples, massacring every last one of them, taking what you can from the village and then burning it, wiping it off the map like one would wipe chalk off a chalkboard. Real genocide has been going on in Darfur for more than a decade now. Now, when genocide happened in Rwanda, policymakers said it happened too quickly. It only happened in a period of months. There was no time to stop it. And whether or not that's true, there's no excuse for Darfur, a conflict where hundreds of thousands are being killed each and every year, and little to nothing is being done about it in the United States or around the world. But who are the perpetrators? Who are the victims? How did this conflict begin? What can be done to stop it? What should be done to stop it? I'm honored today to give you two very impressive guests to talk about the details of the conflict of Darfur, so that you know in 1 hour all you need to know about what's going on there, or at least to stimulate you to find out more about it. My first guest is Alex Meixner. He is the Director of Policy and Government Relations for the Save Darfur Coalition. He's going to give us some of the history, the background, the players, what's going on. How does this kind of thing happen? How does man give his greatest inhumanity to man? And then an even more impressive guest, Mohamed Yahya, a Darfurian refugee, a man who is lucky to be alive, but through perseverance and courage and probably a little bit of luck, he has managed to survive and to come and to tell you what happened in his home place and perhaps what we can all do to stop it. So let me start with Alex Meixner. Alex, welcome to Dialogue here on Pacifica.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'm very glad you're here. I'd like to go over some of the background, and I realize that history can go on for hours and hours. But if you could give, in an encapsulated way, the seeds of the genocide in Darfur, how does all of this start? Where should we go back to begin?
Well, the seeds of the genocide in Darfur really start, outside Darfur, it's odd enough to say. In the southern area of Sudan, there was a long civil war, about 50 years long, in fact, that cost millions of lives between the Khartoum government that's still in power in the north and rebels in the south. Now, in Sudan, as in many countries, the military drew much of its conscriptions from poor areas, and certainly Darfur is one of the poorest areas on earth. It's in the middle of the Sahara Desert, about 1,000 miles from any port, very few roads, very few utilities, little education, really lacking a lot of the things that, should have been there, that the government should have been providing. And yet, many, many Darfurians were sent by the government to go fight in this war in the south. Now, with much international pressure, the war in the south was starting to abate. It was starting to come to an end. The folks on both sides were sitting down at the negotiating table and coming up with an agreement. Now, the people in Darfur saw this. And they saw that those in the south were going to essentially get a bigger slice of the pie. They were going to get some oil revenues. They were going to get some power sharing within the central government. And there was a thought of, well, wait a minute. We've been forced to fight this as well. We don't have any of the things that the south is also missing. And yet we're getting nothing from this. That's not fair. Our government should be looking out for us as well. At that point, some rebel movements did spring up. Now, that's not completely uncommon in the world and certainly not uncommon in the Horn of Africa within the last decade or two. What changed this from what is a relatively common situation in into a genocide was the government of Sudan's reaction to that. What they did was go in with a divide-and-conquer scenario. They essentially picked half the tribes in Darfur. There was a general division that was already there amongst a great many tribes along one dividing line, basically nomadic herders and then farmers. And there had been a self-identification as either African or Arab. Now, it's important to know that when you meet folks from either of these groups of people from Darfur, they're very much alike. You probably none of the listeners would be able to tell the difference upon meeting them. So
the color of their skin, their ethnic features are similar. Whether they consider themselves African or Arab?
Exactly, very much so. So this is really not a racial divide. It was more of a cultural divide that was exploited by the Sudanese government. The government came in and said, okay, I'm going to pick the Arab tribes and going to arm you, going to say that, you can take whatever keep whatever you take, and we want you to put down any of these rebellions, and not only that, but, go further and actually drive these folks off their lands, drive the villages that that had been thought to be supportive or at least were of a similar background of some of the rebel movements off the map, push them out of Darfur.
So ethnic cleansing, if you will.
Exactly. And then the government came in with modern weaponry that hadn't been there before, with air support that certainly hadn't been there, and it turned from a conflict into a genocide with civilian targets, and that's when it truly became the horror that it is.
Now, just give people an idea, because some people don't know where Sudan is. It's one of those interesting countries in most of Africa. North of Africa, north of the Sahara Desert, tends to be Arab, and south of the Sahara Desert tends to be Black Africa, African Africa, if you will. Sudan, since it has the Nile River, actually has bits of both the Arab North and the African South. Is that the source of the conflict?
Well, it's certainly, some of the long-standing tensions are there. Sudan is the largest country geographically in Africa, and it's somewhat unique in that the government of Sudan is both a member of the African Union and the Arab League, so they do kind of straddle both worlds there. But it's really the exploitation of perceived differences that led to the genocide.
Let me go to Mohamed Yahya. Mohamed, you were born, of course, in Darfur in the 1960s. You were telling me on the phone before the interview about something that happened to you when you were just 7 years old. Tell our listeners about that.
First of all, I would like to thank you for having me in this interesting radio show. Yes, I was born in Darfur. And what happened to me early in my life when I was just a kid, about 7 years old in school, I was beaten badly by my Arab teacher.
By your teacher, not by other students,
teacher,
by your teacher.
Just the reason, just because I am speaking, I spoke to my friend who is, one of the colleagues in my language, which is an African language, in my Masalit language. And that became a crime to be punished for it. And he said, you don't have to speak your language here. And this place where you have to speak only Arabic and you have to study only in Arabic, I will never forget that.
So you're 7 years old. I mean, you're a small child. You're speaking your tribal language, the language you grew up with. And your teacher, because you didn't speak Arabic, didn't just tell you speak Arabic, but literally beat you.
He beat me angrily, and he's very frustrated, just like I did a big crime. And that is a very difficult moment for me. I can't even...
Why were the teachers in Darfur Arabs from the north of Sudan? Why weren't they native people from Darfur?
Sudan government, since the independence of Sudan, all the governments came to the power in Sudan are mostly Arabs. And that's why Arabs controlling the country. The country is totally dominant by Arabs, and that's why they are very well educated. They're taking all the resources and... Even the teachers send them out to the different states in Sudan as Arabs.
Now, what's interesting to me is that this is not a religious conflict, right? Both parties, the Arabs and the Africans, they're all Muslim, correct?
All Muslims, and therefore are 100% are Muslims. But they are Black Africans, Muslims, and those who are in North mainly are Arabs. And in Khartoum as well, and the government also are Arabs. They are Arabs.
Now, how do you know the difference between an Arab Sudanese and an African Sudanese? They look pretty much the same, yes?
This is a very good question, Anna. That is hard to tell. We can know that. We know that. But people like you in America or the rest of the world, it is difficult for them to make any distinguishes. Who is who and who is Arabs and who is non-Arabs? Because all of us are black. All of them are black. As a government right now, they are black. And those Darfurians are black. And Nuba Mountain or those from South are black. And but we know each other from the accents, from the language, and from some of the features, like hair, and, you know, even sometimes uniforms or clothes that people wear. And,
let me ask you this. So you said what happened when you were seven. As you grew up in Darfur. What happened next in Darfur? I mean, when did you start to know that things were getting really bad in Darfur?
Really, I got new things really getting bad. Since I was beaten in that time, and I was just a kid, and I realized that there is something wrong going on in this country. And as soon as I grow up, and by the time, and I realized also there is so many violations against those blacks, especially blacks, Sudanese, and from any part of the country, they are treated badly. They are treated badly in the streets. They are treated badly in their works. They are treated badly wherever they get them.
Mohammed, what is the name of your village and what happened to your village?
Yes. My village is a small village at the eastern part of Al Jinena, and that village was totally destroyed right now. It's totally destroyed, and you know, it's the first of those villages attacked in 1993.
1993. So this goes back already almost 15 years. Your village was attacked. How was it attacked? What happened?
Yes. In that time, I was in Egypt when I came back and forth to study. And I'm studying in Al-Azhar University in Cairo. And I came from, you know, from Darfur. And after that, the government of Sudan, with those Janjaweed Arab militias, attacked my village and totally destroyed. They attacked my village among other 50 villages. And destroyed them in one day.
They destroyed 50 villages in one day. Now, you weren't in the village when it was destroyed.
No, I was not in that.
You were in Egypt at the time. That's why you survived, I guess.
Yes, I just came to my studies, and I spent my vacation with them. And when I came, that happened.
But your entire family was in this village.
My entire family, you know, I lost 21 of my family members.
21 family members.
21 of my family members and close relatives.
Your mother, your father?
They died in one day. But fortunately, yes, my mother and my dad, my parents, are surviving, along with three others. And those, when they are fleeing, they sent me a letter, and they're telling me that we have been attacked by Arabs. We don't know where those people are coming from. And the government also with them, because we see the truth, we see the, you know, cars, and we see those kind of Land Cruisers and guns and the same uniforms and others with just casual dress, and they attacked us and they killed 21 immediately, and we don't know even the rest of others, you know, and they killed thousands of people and destroyed those 50 villages in one day. Even what they said to me, we are fleeing right now. We don't know where to go. We don't know where to go. Because there is no any camp in that time, because that was the beginning.
Let me ask Alex Meister, and then I'm going to open up the phones and give our listeners a chance to ask you some good questions. But Alex, so you have the Arab Janjaweed militia, and they're going in and they're massacring the inhabitants. They're destroying 50 villages. What do they expect to gain from this? What is their goal?
Well, originally, what they were gaining was money and weaponry from the Sudanese government, and also the carte blanche to take what they found in the villages. You know, much wealth in Darfur is relatively portable in the form of, you know, camels or other animals that then could be taken. And, you know, there's just a direct benefit to the Janjaweed. What we're seeing recently, though, is that there's frankly not that many villages left to be hit. So the Janjaweed have started attacking not only the refugee camps themselves, but also some of the humanitarian aid convoys, and in fact are spreading cross borders into Chad and the Central African Republic. So this this thirst for more goods by way of attack is now spinning largely out of control.
But what is the goal? I mean, if there's nothing left to take, if the camels are all gone and they're just people, they're just refugees, what fuels this murderous anger to kill innocent people?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that you know, I wish I had an answer to.
Okay, fair enough. I want to give our callers a chance to call in and join the discussion. The number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. You can call in, you can ask a question, you can challenge our guests if you want, or you can talk about, I'd like to hear, I want to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about not just what's going on, but what should be done, what the world community should do, if anything, to try to stop this ongoing genocide. A quick break. We'll be right back. 202-588-0893. Right back after this. Welcome back to Dialogue. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're discussing what's going on in Darfur, the genocide there. I'm trying to give you all the details with Alex Meixner, the Director of Policy and Government Relations for the Save Darfur Coalition, and Mohamed Yahya, a Darfurian refugee who was studying in Egypt and came back to find his village, his home village where he lived all his life, destroyed, 21 of his relatives massacred. And I want to talk about what can be done, what should be done to stop this. I'm going to get back to our guests in just a second. We're going to talk about what the world has done, or more appropriately, hasn't done to help stop the genocide. But first, let's go to Howard in Silver Spring. Howard, welcome to Dialogue. Howard in Silver Spring, Maryland, are you there? I think we've lost Howard. Let me go back then to our guests just briefly, and I want to ask, Alex first. So these attacks happened, as Mohammed has testified to, they happened as early as the early 90s. What happened since then? I mean, this, many people never even heard of Darfur until just a few years ago.
Well, you're right. There's always been, or not always, but there has been for quite some time, a simmering level of violence in Darfur. What again, you know, moved it from beyond what is, had been the norm for violence levels into the level of genocide was the Sudanese government's direct exploitation of the simmering violence that was already there, turning it into a genocide. You know, if we think back to what happened in Rwanda with the radio programs and the incitement of so many people to go out and kill their neighbors, there was something of that in Darfur as well, insofar as the Sudanese government really did just drum up this hatred and unleash half of Darfur against the other half. And that really took place beginning in 2003 and then really got into full swing in 2004.
Now, Mohammed, where were you in 2003, 2004? Were you in Egypt at that time?
Yes, in 2003 I was here. I just came here to the United States and I got asylum and settlement.
Why did you come here to the United States from Egypt, which of course borders Sudan, is very close to your country?
Yes, I think the only country that, recognized me as asylum seeker or as a refugee to get a protection in the United States of America, because I was applied to embassy of the United States, and I applied to many different European embassies. And
were you unsafe in Egypt? Was it not safe for you there?
Yes, and I also applied to United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they recognized me and accepted me to come to United States of America.
Well, I'm just in Egypt. Were you safe in Egypt or
yes,
unsafe?
In Egypt, I was not safe in Egypt, and that's why I got this asylum.
What was going on in Egypt? Why weren't
in
you safe
Egypt,
there?
Yes, because we are the first group of students or grassroots. We started to speak out about what's going on in Darfur, and we start to write about it. We start to make conferences and speak out and send letters abroad. But the government, that angers the government of Sudan, and through the embassy of Sudan in Egypt, they started to chase me and my friends
They started to chase you. The government of Sudan in Egypt started to chase you.
Exactly. And even they used my colleagues, students, who we study together in the same university. But they are loyalists to the government, and they get paid, and they use them to chase us. And even tried to kill me twice.
They tried to kill you twice?
Yes, me and my friend. And
how did they try to kill you?
Yes, first they tried to crush me by car. And,
really?
Yes. Fortunately, we survived from that. And also, the second time, they tried to poison us.
Well, thank God you're here safely in the United States.
Thanks to God that I'm here. And that's why I granted a refugee status to be here in the United States.
Let me go to Hagos in Tacoma Park. Hagos, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much. Although I share the brother's pain and suffering and as a refugee, the gentleman, the expert, he does not speaking the truth. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a neo-colonialism by the so-called secessionists and self-determinationists and independence. This is European neo-colonialism.
Well, who's the European here? We have Arab Sudanese fighting African Sudanese.
Number one, there are no Arab Sudanese. You are misled, sister or brother, by this Judeo-Zionist who controls the media and everything. There is no Arab. Number one.
There's no Arabs in Sudan?
The Sudanese government. Do they look like Caucasian? They are Ethiopian. We are not even Sudanese. They are not Sudanese. The name Sudan was given by Britain.
But I'm trying to understand what you're saying. You're blaming Israel for the genocide in Sudan? Is that correct? I just want to understand what your point is, because I'm missing
collectively,
it.
From here, from Washington, D.C., from Pat Robinson, moral majority, this guy, Jerry Farwell, who died.
I'm not a supporter of Pat Robinson or Jerry Farwell, but I'm trying to understand what they have to do with Sudan.
Organizing group of people to fight and control a land so they can control the minerals. As they said it, we don't need the niggers, we need their minerals. It is politics and economy.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, Hagos, I'll address your questions to my guests. Let me start, I guess, with Mohammed. Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, I'm no fan of either of them. Do they have a role in Sudan?
It is very unfortunate that to hear this kind of comments from someone he was not even in Sudan and he don't know what's exactly going on in Sudan. When this incident started since 1993, and over 500,000 of people killed in Darfur right now by the government's claim to be an Arab and Muslim government, killing its own people who are exactly Muslims like them, but because they are black, and this is racism. This is not a religion, and this is something else. And we get someone to deny and to talk this kind of talk. But this is very unfortunate, Tana. We have nothing to hide today because all the world know what is going on. It is genocide. It was a genocide, and it was huge mass killings and rape of women and even girls. Kids of 5 years old get raped every day when they go to collect firewood, and this is something shameful and beyond a comprehension, and I can't believe that someone could deny that. I can't believe that. Devils never do this at all, but we have human beings, what so-called the NIF, National Islamic Front, by the name of Islam, by the name of Arabism, they using the power to kill human beings indiscriminately this terrible way, never happened in the history. At all. And I can't just imagine someone could deny that.
Let me go to Nick in Reston, Virginia. Nick, welcome to Dialogue.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Nick.
Let's get something right here because the introduction was a little misleading. What happened is that when Islam was being spread, people from the Arab Peninsula, that is Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Kuwait and Iraq and all those places, but mainly Saudi Arabia. They spread Islam, like you know. So they moved from Saudi Arabia down to Egypt, to Sudan, and you know, Somalia, and all those places. You can call them colonizers. Well, as they were spreading Islam, they were colonizing and then setting themselves up as the rulers of these lands then. And they have continued to rule it today. They are not. It's about 10% to 20%, you know, of the general population. But they have arrogated themselves the power to power of life and death, if you will, like you've seen now. So that's the basic truth.
Nick, I'm just curious. Do you have a connection to the region? I'm just wondering. You may not. I just couldn't tell from the accent if you yourself have a connection to Sudan.
No, I've not. Okay. I'm not from Sudan myself.
I just wanted to know. That's all. Go ahead, please.
I come from Nigeria myself.
Nigeria.
And we have
okay.
exactly the same problem. It has not, ballooned to this point, but from the way things are going, it will go that way too. We're having the same problem from the, Arab, Arab Africans.
Well, Nick, let me ask you, and then I'm going to get to my guests, but what is the answer? How do you stop this genocide?
I'm coming to that now.
Please.
But so this is what's going on now. If the last caller was trying to say, and I'm sorry he didn't say it very well, is that if the United States is serious, if Britain is serious, they should, the way they have captured Charles Taylor and put him on trial, the same with Milosevic. That's the way they should capture, what's his name now? It escapes me. Capture the so-called president of Sudan and his lieutenants. Capture them and put them on trial at the ICJ.
Well, that's
otherwise, the United States is just a laughable joke. If they can't. You know, go and arrest those people and put them on trial. Then it's a joke. That's the only way it can be stopped.
Well, that is a great question and a great issue, and I'm glad you raised it. I appreciate it. The phone call, if others want to call in, is 202-588-0893. Let me address that question that Nick raised to Alex. Why isn't the United States going into Sudan as we went into Iraq to try Saddam Hussein, or as we went into to Serbia to try Milosevic? Why isn't the United States or the world community in general going into Sudan to stop this genocide and to, as Nick says, put the president on trial for genocide, for war crimes?
Well, I think what we see in Sudan is something of an opposite strategy from what we saw in Iraq. And that Iraq was very unilateral. It was just a decision to go outside of the normal mechanisms for international conflict resolution. Sudan is progressing through those normal mechanisms, and they're unfortunately painfully slow at times. But what we do have, just within the last month and a half, is a new UN Security Council resolution authorizing a force of some 26,000 troops and police and then a few more thousand civilian personnel to keep the peace in Darfur. It would be the largest and will be the largest and most complex peacekeeping force ever, in fact. That's a major step in the right direction. It has started to plan. They've gotten some commitments. They are starting to do the very beginning of that deployment. The goal is to have those troops on the ground by early next summer in total, but to begin their deployment immediately.
Okay, but Alex, Mohammed's...
I
was going to say Mohammed's village was destroyed 15 years ago. I mean, isn't this too little, too late?
It's certainly too late, and it may in fact be too little, but it's what can be done to ensure that there's not another village that's destroyed, a year from now. There are... Still, we must remember some 2.5 million internally displaced people in Sudan and refugees in Chad that can't go home yet, that are still living in constant danger, that the violence could tick back up to the rates we saw a few years ago in terms of just, scores and scores of killed. We can't allow that to happen. The first step in doing that is getting in a peacekeeping force to protect civilians.
Who is in this peacekeeping force? You said 26,000. Is the United States part of it? Is it mostly African nations, Arab nations? Who comprises this force?
The commitments are being finalized now. It will largely be African troops. The U.S. will likely have some engineers, perhaps some some role in terms of airlift and certainly a role in funding over a quarter of it. It will have a Western component in terms of some of the command and control, some of the helicopters, the attack helicopters and transport that are commonly found only in Western militaries. But again, it would be the largest and most complex UN peacekeeping force. So too little, too late. But finally, there is movement internationally and multilaterally to get a force in there.
The force you think will be in? You think it'll be in a month and a half? You said
It'll begin deployment in a month and a half. It will take until they're projecting next June or so to get the force fully in there. And we also should remember there are already about 7,400 African Union peacekeepers in Darfur. Unfortunately, they're underfunded, under-equipped. They don't have the right mandate, and frankly, they're not getting the job done, which is why we need a bigger, better peacekeeping force.
Mohammed, let me ask you what your view is on the United Nations force that's coming in. I assume you think it's a good sign. Is it enough?
Sir, yes, I think that is enough if they really implemented immediately, as Alex said. We need them to be implemented immediately. It was, that's going to make a job done in a well way and in a very right way, and because they're going to make a difference. But we need them, in my perspective and in my experience. We don't need them only African Union, as the government of Sudan asking for. We want them United Nations peacekeepers from America, from the West, from all over the world, not only African Union, because African Union has proven a failure since they deployed over there towards the ceasefire from 2004. They are not able to do anything, and that's why we are not expecting them to do more if they just deployed them without other United Nations peacekeepers.
Mohammed, are you angry at the world for allowing this conflict to fester for so long, to allow so many people to be massacred? And now it seems there is some progress, and we certainly should praise that, but it seems to be coming very late in the day. What's your view?
Sir, I am really very angry. I am very angry. I am very frustrated. Since I was started working on this, it is for over a decade, almost more than 15 years, we are talking about this and, sending those informations. And the United Nations, Kofi Annan, before he leaves, in 1999, he received our open letter to the international community about the hidden slaughters and ethnic cleansing in Western Sudan, which is Darfur. And he quoted often in his General Assembly of United Nations from 1999, 2000, until 2001. And he said, there is something happening in Darfur, and we have to find that out and stop it.
He never stopped it
until he left United Nations. And I feel that United Nations playing games. United Nations are not serious. They have been very reluctant. They are not doing anything to stop the genocide in Darfur. And even they ignored for a long time to mention it by its own name or call it genocide. And they call it other names. This is a catastrophe. This is one of the worst humanitarian crises in the 20th century. That is, unbelievable. It's just frustrating that we will not getting the help in the manner of time to stop this genocide, and it's still going on and going, and given the government of Sudan to be very confident, because they know no one will take the initiative to stop the genocide in Darfur.
Mohammed, are you angry at the government of the United States as well for not acting more quickly?
I am angry from the government of the United States as well, because the government of the United States is the one of the powerful governments all over the world. The government of the United States has played a major role and wonderful initiatives in the rest of the world. They treat Iraq they freed Kuwait from Iraq when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1991, and they sent Saddam out and defeated, and they liberated Kuwait. They sent just a couple months ago to Lebanon, where the war has erupted between Hezbollah and Israel. They sent peacekeepers and United Nations over there only in 1 month, and they stopped that war. Unfortunately, also they did that in Yugoslavia. They did that in so many different places in Afghanistan.
And of course,
unfortunately, they failed. They are not willing to do it in Darfur.
And in Iraq and Kuwait, there was no genocide going on either.
There is no genocide going in Iraq. There is no genocide even going in Lebanon.
Right.
There is no genocide going in other places. Only in Rwanda and in Holocaust and in Darfur right now, which is the only 21st century genocide is taking place. And people are dying right now when we are talking in this radio. People are dying. The rape is going on, the displacement is going on, and the government is bombing right now villages and killing them and displacing them. Unfortunately, no one take any initiative. Ban Ki-moon visited and he came and go back and forth, unfortunately.
The phone number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. I want to hear what you think should be done, can be done, what can be done to help in Darfur. Maybe nothing should be done. Maybe you don't think the United States or other countries should do something. I want to hear whatever your views are. Give us a call, 202-588-0893. Let's go to Fred in Laurel, Maryland. Fred, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, first of all, I must say I was a little disappointed with the last but one caller who seemed to dismiss the fact that there's genocide going on over there and that there's Arabs are carrying out atrocities against blacks in that area. That is exactly what's going on there.
Some people can't seem to see the facts before their eyes because it messes with their preconceptions.
Yeah, well, okay. I suppose that man may probably be a former Janjaweed himself who has come out here, because by the way he spoke, he seemed to just endorse what those Janjaweed are doing on the poor people. Anyway, coming to the question of what I think might be the solution. First of all, I think the African leaders themselves must be made to realize that they need to take active measures, you know, because they have been kind of half-hearted in what they're doing. They're not taking, like, for instance, on the question of whether the hybrid team, the hybrid forces that should go to Darfur should be all African. Some of them, I mean, seem to support that it should be all African. I am totally against that. Because
why are you against that?
This African Union peacekeeping force that has been there, and like Mohammed said, they've been able to do nothing.
Why do you think that is, Fred? Why do you think they've been able to do nothing? Is it they just don't have enough resources? They don't have enough arms, training, or is
all of that, plus the fact that you know, the numbers. Darfur is about the size of I think some people say about the size of France.
It's a very large country, a province of a country.
Yes, and you know, and these Janjaweed are people who know how to move around that area, and they're in big numbers. So to have 7,000 people who are ill-equipped, who are ill-motivated, and all that to do that work is, I mean, laughable. So, to say the least. So
well, let me ask Alex the question. If the African troops were better armed, better funded, would they do a better job, or is this really something the international community needs to take charge of?
Well, that may have helped. The most deficient thing about the African Union force was, in fact, their mandate and the degree to which they were carrying it out. You know, 7,000 troops can be effective, not everywhere in Darfur, but they could have been effective some places in Darfur if they were more aggressive about protecting civilians, about protecting women from rape as they went on marches to find firewood. You know,
why
there are
weren't
things that
they?
Even a limited number of troops could have done. What we haven't seen is them doing that, and that
why
really
not?
Becomes the question for this UN force. You know, we know they'll be well equipped, we know they'll be well funded, but it's going to come down to whether they have the will to do what's necessary to actually proactively protect civilians, or if they merely go and occupy space.
Here's what I'm trying to understand, Alex. You have 7,000 troops from the African Union that are sent there to try to stop the conflict. Why weren't they more effective? Is it simply that the governments that sent them didn't have the will to intervene? Or what's going on here? Why wouldn't they stop a woman getting firewood from being raped?
Well, you know, that's a good question. What we've seen with the AU force was something of a breakdown in terms of force control. In some sectors and with some contingents, particularly the peacekeepers the Rwandans sent up, they were very aggressive in protecting civilians, given their own history.
I was just
going to
say, I'm sure the Rwandans were very aggressive.
Exactly, but some other contingents were much less so. They basically sat in their camps and did very little. Now, yes, they were under-equipped. Yes, they were underfunded. In fact, there's many thousands of these soldiers that haven't been paid in quite some time. But it's also true that there was just not a cohesive a cohesive sense of the mission. And, you know, it's not really surprising, given that this was the African Union's first major peacekeeping deployment, whereas the UN's been doing this for decades now. So we're expecting a lot more of the UN, and, you know, we hope we see it.
Let me go to Yvonne in Arlington. I think we just lost Yvonne. All right, let's go to Kathleen. Kathleen, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. I want to make a clarification, and that is the caller who sort of set off a firestorm of protest, who said that there weren't Arabs doing this in Sudan.
Right.
He's correct in the sense that the people who are doing this, they're black people.
That's true.
They are not Semitic Arabs in the traditional sense of the term. What Arabs have done as a tool of imperialism and domination is that what they have basically defined as Arab is someone who is born into an Arab-speaking family whose first language is Arabic. And because you have a situation where the indigenous blacks of the region are oppressed, they have internalized the virulent strain of anti-black racism that is present in Arabic society. And they do not want to self-identify as black, so they self-identify as Arab, and they act as proxies for the Arabs. And that is what is going on.
Kathleen, that's a great point, and let me address that to Mohammed. Mohammed, do you agree with Kathleen?
I can agree with Kathleen, but I have some difference here.
Okay.
I know we're born in Sudan, and we know who is Arab and who is not Arab. So when we see them, we know just Arabs, even they're black like us. And people insisted to call their name, to call themselves an Arabs, and to be, they asked, you know, they wanted to be identified as Arabs. And we know they speak Arabic. When they came to Sudan, they came in seventh century to Sudan and to spread the Islam as they claimed, and unfortunately, but that's not the reason we realize that they came to spread terrorism and to spread, their propaganda and to control Sudan. And they have other also mission to do in the rest of Africa and the world. That's what's exactly going on over there. And they try to prove that they're Arabs by killings and raping and displace and destroy everyone who is not Arab.
But Mohammed, let me ask you this.
Systematically, exactly is going on over there.
Let me ask you this.
I believe that someone saying those are not Arabs.
Okay, but 50, 60, 70, 100 years ago, wasn't there a lot of intermarriage between the people who call themselves Arabs in Sudan and the people who call themselves Africans in Sudan? I mean, so much so that it became hard to tell the difference. Do you agree with me? If you don't, please tell me you don't. And if so, what caused the ethnic divide to re-intensify?
If I want to go to explain this, will take us a little bit more. You know, it is very interesting that in Islam, when Arabs or Muslims, they go somewhere to spread Islam like exactly missionaries do in Christianity, they go peacefully and people welcome them somewhere and to accept them and to get them place to live. And that's what exactly happened in Sudan. When they came, our people in Darfur are there, and southern peoples Sudanese are there, and Nuba Mountain, who are all black people. That's why Sudan called Sudan, it means black. Those black people are in Sudan before Arab came.
That's actually an important thing. I just want to point out. I just want to say that Sudan is the Arabic word for black. It's one of the things I learned in my research.
Sudan is Arabic word for black, and they wanted to change that name right now. That's why they're doing this. And I know for sure when those people came over there, our grand people, they, you know, get them the land and they welcome them because they came peacefully to spread the Islam. And even they never get their woman with them because they came for dawah. When, you know, in Islam someone say this is dawah and he is coming for dawah, he don't have even to get his wife with him or his kids with him. They have to leave them over there and they have to come by themselves because that is a good for the sake of the God.
Okay, so they came peacefully.
Right. If they died, they will go to the heaven and to the paradise. If they never died and they did their job very well, they will be rewarded and they can get married from the place that they go. That's why they get married from Darfur. They get married from South of Sudan. They get married from Nuba Mountain.
Okay, but I want to move on.
And they get on black.
Mohammed,
they don't want to accept the fact that they're black and to respect those people. Like in America, we all Americans, we are proud to be Americans. That's it. We don't have to differentiate people in colors and in ethnicities or in language or whatsoever.
Well, there's racism in America, too, certainly. But what I guess I'm trying to figure out is to what extent did Arabs and Africans get along for a time in Sudan? And if you agree that there was a period when they did get along, and if so, what exacerbated the differences? That's what I'm trying to understand, Mohammed.
Yes, the differences right now between those who claim to be Arabs and non-Arabs, right?
Right. What did, was there a time when people got along better than today? And if so, what caused people to be more angry at each other?
Yes, this is a great question. You know, our people who are normally black people, they accept those people. They accept anyone, and they are very passionate, and they are very generous. But those who are claims to be Arabs, they don't accept us. They hate us. They hate us just simply because we are black, you know, and we don't speak Arabic. They force us to speak Arabic. They force us to even learn Arabic, to study in Arabic, to sing in Arabic, to dance in Arabic. And we have our own culture. We have our own language. And we need to access to speak our language. We need to sing in our language. We need to study in our language. And that was not allowed in Sudan. And they trying to urbanize those who are not Arabs and force them. And that's why people don't like that. And they turn it to kill them or wipe them out, since they don't want to accept this fact. This is not right.
The phone number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. Let's go to Paul in Silver Spring. Paul, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi. I just wanted to make really two comments, but in response to your most recent question, to fully understand what is going on between so-called Arabs and the African Sudanese, is that there was an organic spread of Islam that was taking place in the late 1700s, 1800s. And as Britain came into power, what they did was favor the northern Sudanese, who were, you know, they're called Arabs, but it's a blend. It's a mix between Arabs that did come over from Saudi Arabia, you know, hundreds of years ago, you know, for generations, and the indigenous people there. But if you look at them in terms of color, they'll be brown, but they're called Arabs, and it's kind of confusing, you know, to say it's Arabs against the blacks, because in terms of color, there's hardly much difference.
Well, Paul, let me address your question to Alex. Alex, to what extent did Britain, in its role as colonial power, exacerbate the conflict between the so-called Arabs and Africans of Sudan?
Well, you know, it's getting a little bit outside my realm of expertise, as mostly I deal with the current conflict. I will say that certainly colonialism does, you know, has played a large role in setting up the dynamics within which this conflict has sprung up. But you know, as per the history of the region, that's getting unfortunately a bit outside my purview.
Fair enough. Let's go to Yvonne in Arlington. Yvonne, welcome to Dialogue. Yvonne, are you there?
Oh yes, finally.
Yes, we are here. Talk to us.
Thank you for the opportunity so that I can ask the question. First, I want to say it is very sad to see such ancient people destroying themselves over some false beliefs, apparently, which they've absorbed, which makes them refuse to accept themselves as Sudanese people. And so they do irresponsible things like raping their children and women. My question has to do with the natural resources in the Darfur region. I have a feeling that there must be some very valuable resources in the Darfur region which are not being discussed. If you have an expert to talk about the natural resources there, which the rest of the world may want or covet.
Well, that's
I'd
a great
like
question. Alex, are there significant natural resources in Darfur that someone might want to have, whether African or Arab or United Nations, the United States?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. There's not a lot of found or proven resources within Darfur itself, but there are huge resources, huge oil resources in the larger country of Sudan, specifically in southern Sudan, although very close to its border with the north in what's called the Abyei region. Now, that South Sudan civil war I referred to earlier, in the peace agreement that ended it, there was a provision which allowed for a national election in 2009. And then the possibility of a referendum in 2011 within which the South could actually secede from
Sudan. Now, if that were to happen, a lot of the oil wealth, you know, either if the South were to win in 2009 or if they were to secede in 2011, a lot of that oil wealth would, you know, become under the control of the South and would
move
away from
the Khartoum
government.
Now, the South is black, African, and largely Christian. Is that right?
It is indeed. So there is a disturbing pattern that we're seeing just recently now in Darfur, where there are, you know, again, quote-unquote, self-identified Arab tribes being resettled into Darfur from outside Darfur, either from elsewhere in Sudan or indeed from Chad and from Niger that are being brought in. And the theory goes that they're being brought in by the Sudanese government, given land, in order to support the current Sudanese government in these elections coming up. So there are resources at stake in which Darfur will play a role. But it's not resources in Darfur itself.
Well, and in terms of the South and the North, is there still fighting going on there between black Christians and Arab Muslims?
The formal fighting has ended, indeed, with this peace agreement a few years ago. But what we're not seeing is full implementation of that agreement. The northern government was supposed to have its troops out of Abyei, out of the South by now. They've refused to do that. There is definitely a growing tension.
So we have another conflict around the corner, then, it sounds like.
Potentially. I mean, that's one of the things that certainly we want to see in the South, and eventually we hope to see in Darfur, is a peace agreement that then has to be followed through on. It's so often that you'll see countries in the international community provide the pressure necessary to get an agreement, but then turn away, take the spotlight away when it comes time for implementation and follow through. We really need to maintain the international community's focus on Sudan as a whole to ensure that that Darfur is brought to peace and that it's a lasting peace, and that the situation in the South doesn't exacerbate a problem in Darfur or, in fact, spark a new conflict there.
202-588-0893. Sandra and Adams Morgan, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. About natural resources, there is oil in Darfur. There is a woman who's been blogging on the Internet since 2004 about oil, and I read recently that sometime this spring, and I believe the company is Scandinavian, they began drilling for oil in Darfur. Now, about the settlement of non-Darfuris in Darfur, the same thing is happening with the flooding of Nubia in the north. Under the Four Freedoms Agreement, which Bashir signed with Egypt, Egyptians are going to, once the Nubians are displaced from the land by the flooding, they are not going to be allowed to return to the region. There will be Semitic Arabs from Egypt who will come into Sudan and settle that region. They're
Sandra,
going to
let me ask you this.
The Four Freedoms Agreement to move freely, to live, to work, and to own the land.
Sandra, let me ask you this. You're clearly very educated. You know a lot about the conflict. What, in your view, is the way to resolve this? Do you support the UN troops? Should there be more? What do you think?
I definitely support the AU, UN peacekeepers in Sudan, because, quite frankly, even though it's not a perfect solution, it is the only solution we have right now to the protection and preservation of human life in Darfur. In terms of long-term solutions, the international community needs to put pressure on Bashir to honor the CPA in the South, which he is not honoring for obvious reasons. And there needs to be a united front among the various marginalized peoples in Sudan. You have the Nubians in the north being removed from the land through the flooding of their region, the building of the dams. You have what's going on in Darfur. In the central of the country, you have the Nuba in the Nuba Mountains, and for years they have been being moved off their land and replaced by mechanized farming. And you have what's going on in the south. It's an ongoing campaign of Arabization. There is a thrust on the part of this Arabized government of Bashir to make Sudan the new Egypt. Sudan is the new beachhead for the imperialism and expansion of Arabs on the African continent.
Thank you
and
for your call.
The indigenous peoples of Sudan need to organize, and they need to return Sudanese government to a democratically elected government.
Thank you for your call, Sandra. I appreciate it. We're running out of time. I'm sorry to cut you off. Mohammed, I don't know if you have a very brief response or comment on what Sandra has said.
Yes, Sandra, she really touched a very important point, and that's right. And exactly what's going on in Darfur is resettling the Arabs from different neighboring countries, from Chad, Arab from Niger, Arab from even Cameroon, Arab from Mali, they have been resettled over there. Tens of thousands of Arab right now resettled in the villages that destroyed and displaced the people of Darfur. This is a very dangerous time. Also, we have resources of oil, and that's according to many studies that there is Darfur is flooding. It's just like a lake of oil. And we, because of the war, there is not able to get this oil out. And also Darfur is the richest state, in not only in Sudan, in even Africa, you know, by animal resources. And we send, you know, or export fresh meat and live animals to the over 20 Arab countries, totally relying on the fresh meat from Sudan, like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia, like Gulf, like even Libya and different countries totally relying on this.
Okay, Mohammed, I have to cut you off because we have only one time for one more caller, and I happen to have to ask you to make it fairly brief. Osman in Virginia, welcome to Dialogue. Osman,
hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. I have some comments about what Mohammed's been talking about.
Yes.
I'm from Sudan.
Yes.
And there is one thing I need to tell you, is that late 1800, the population of Sudan was less than 3 million. And all this immigration from black or Arab is coming from West Africa. Actually, there is no migration from Middle East or anywhere. All the Arab was settled a long time ago. I'm not Arabic ethnic, but I don't see the conflict in Darfur is ethnic.
You don't see it as ethnic, Osman. What do you see it as?
Yeah, I see that.
I tell you, we're running out of time, so I have to ask you to give me like a 20-second answer. What is, in your view, the basis of the conflict, if not ethnicity? Osman, are you there? I'm afraid we lost him. All right. I'm sorry for that. You know, this thing goes very, very fast. An hour flew by. There's still so much to talk about. I want to thank Alex Meixner and Mohammed Yahya for sharing their stories. Mohammed for sharing his pain. Alex, the work you do at Save Darfur Coalition, very, very briefly, what can someone do if they want to help?
Well, thank you, Mark, for this opportunity. And, what's abundantly clear from today's show is that there's much more that needs to be done, and it will only be done if sufficient political pressure is kept on the U.S. government, kept on foreign governments. Please, all your listeners can visit www.savedarfur.org to find out how they can help. If any of your listeners are overseas or are traveling there soon, there's www.globeforDarfur.org, which is kind of a pan-European, pan-African, pan-Middle East.
I have to cut you off. SaveDarfur.org and GlobeForDarfur.org. You can also find information from my website, RadioInsightScoop.com. Thank you all very much for listening today, and tune in next time for Dialogue. This is Mark Levine signing off.